I guess I need a microphone here, don't I? Okay. How's this? Okay, this is good. Thank you, Mike, and thanks to the Grassroots Network for inviting me to speak at this enormously important time on this enormously important subject. In my view, the world and this country are at a crossroads, a juncture that will shape our lives and the lives of people around the world for decades to come. This isn't so much a battle for Middle Earth, as they put it in The Lord of the Rings, but a battle for planet Earth, and Iraq is at the very center of this. And for all the anger at George Bush, for all the media coverage, for all the books that are pouring out on this subject, for the round-the-clock television coverage of this, I think that the enormity of the moment and the actual stakes of what's going on in Iraq and the actual stakes involved with this whole Bush agenda are still not understood by the public at large. I feel a little bit like Harry Potter and his allies in this new Harry Potter book, The Order of the Phoenix. And if you're not familiar with it, ask your kids. They'll tell you about it. Lord Voldemort, the epitome of evil. He's sort of the George Bush of the magic world, if you will. He has returned, and the established order and the broad masses, if you will, refuse to believe it because believing it would confront them with the challenge of acting to stop it, and it would push them far, far out of their comfort zones. And Harry and Dumbledore and his gang are aware of it and are trying to make other people aware of it. And I think that's what we've got to do today. It's this afternoon. See, here I'm going on autopilot. This afternoon, I want to talk about the occupation, what it's about, and why it's gone bad. I also want to talk about the Bush agenda at home, because I think this is quite closely connected to the war around the world, and I think we have to understand that in order to understand the enormity of the moment and how we should react. I'm going to connect things like the furor over gay marriage and the invasion of Iraq, this new Mel Gibson movie, The Passion of the Christ, and this overall war on terror, because these things are in fact connected. And I'm going to talk about what I think we should do about all of it and the potential for resistance at this point in time. I was very glad that the last panel talked about why the war occurred. I think it's essential to understand that. You cannot understand the occupation without understanding the war. The occupation is a continuation of the war. The occupation is an effort to realize the war aims of the U.S. government. And as I said earlier, these war aims did not spring from the family dynamics or even the corporate connections of Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and this gang as individuals. It flowed from the deepest necessities of the current order of global capitalism or imperialism. This is the system that demands the global exploitation of labor, markets, and resources on an ever-expanding scale. It's a system that demands the political control by a handful of industrialized countries of vast stretches of the globe. It's a system that constantly gives rise to tensions between various centers of world power, as we are seeing between France and Germany on one hand, for example, and the United States on the other. It's a system that inevitably leads to war and intervention. What does this mean concretely? Sometimes I use a paraphrase of the James Bond movie of a few years ago, The World Isn't Enough. Well, in the minds of people and Bush and Cheney and the rest of the U.S. ruling class, most of the world isn't enough. They want the whole thing. But let's get even more specific. And I'm going to draw here on the words of George W. Bush. Often, and I recommend that you do try this method at home, often when the representatives of this system condemn their adversaries, usually their condemnations apply 1,000 times more to themselves Try this method at home and see if it doesn't work for you. And I'm going to quote George Bush's speech of a week or so ago, his first of six speeches on the occupation. He claimed the terrorists have a vision that guides and explains all their varied acts of murder. Well, so does the U.S. government. They want to rule country by country across the greater Middle East. Wow. That's precisely the U.S. agenda in the Middle East. They want total control of every person, mind and soul. What's the Patriot Act? What's watch what you say? What's with us or against us? They seek bases of operation to train more killers and export more violence. Well, who's gotten more military bases across the greater Middle East than any other country or power in the world since September 11th? I think you know the answer. I'm not going to give it to you. They commit dramatic acts of murder to shock, frighten, and demoralize civilized nations. I mean, whose strategy was shock and awe? They seek weapons of mass destruction to impose their will through blackmail and catastrophic attacks. Who has more weapons of mass destruction than anyone else on earth? So I want to thank George W. Bush for giving us a concrete glimpse into what sort of an agenda that he and his cohorts are pursuing in Iraq and around the world. How does Iraq's occupation fit into this? You know, I think some, even in the anti-war movement, have been confused about this. But I think why, first we've got to ask ourselves, here is an administration, a government that consistently lied to get us into the war. Why, for one moment, should we believe they're telling us the truth now when they want to bring liberty to people in the Middle East, and why those who are opposing them are either terrorists or Saddam dead-enders? Why should we possibly believe a word of that? The opposite is the case. This is a war to impose greater U.S. control of Iraq for U.S. imperialist interests. It's precisely the opposite of liberation. What is the United States trying to do in Iraq? And I'm not arguing here that they'll succeed, but these are their aims. They want to turn Iraq into a pro-U.S. neo-colony in the heart of the Middle East. They want to remove an impediment to their control of the Persian Gulf and install a pro-U.S. regime. This is why they handpicked the Iraqi Governing Council. This is why they did not let anti-U.S. elements in it. This is why they've consistently discouraged elections at all levels of Iraqi society and still refuse to allow elections. And this is why they appointed a CIA agent as the head of this new Iraqi government. And this is why they're shutting down newspapers. You know, they shut down Muqtada Sadr's newspaper. This is what started the whole clash with him. And their excuse was he printed lies that incited violence. Why not shut the New York Times down then? They printed lies about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction that incited a war. They want to turn Iraq into a military platform. As soon as they conquered Iraq, they signed an agreement, or they began planning for four permanent military bases. More recently, I read something that said they wanted 14. It's this new interim government, so-called. This isn't even discussed. Do they have the right to tell the U.S. that they can't have these bases? And what's the United States trying to do with this? Again, let's turn to the horse's mouth and turn it around 180 degrees. In January this year, some of you may have caught it, the New York Times had an article, buried page 6 or 7, Powell reassures Russians on troop deployment. And I looked at this article and I thought, gee, why is he having to reassure the Russians? I thought these people were friends now. And you read the article and Colin Powell says, we're not trying to surround anybody. And I said, thank you, Secretary Powell, for explaining to me exactly what the United States is trying to do. This has been the most massive redeployment of U.S. military forces since, according to the Wall Street Journal, since World War II, and it's an effort to ring Russia and China with bases stretching from Western China through North Africa, with Iraq at the very heart of it. And this is part of what we discussed on this panel just earlier, an attempt to prevent those countries from rising to challenge the United States, and an attempt to exert greater control over the Middle East and Central Asia, where 80% of the world's energy sources are located. Jay Garner, the former U.S. viceroy in Iraq, said he looked at Iraq as a coaling station like the Philippines were in the early 1900s. So this is a military platform is another part of this agenda. They want to turn it into an oil platform by gaining control of Iraq's oil, by further developing that oil. They can both, on one hand, try to ease the crisis of supply and demand on the global economy. They can also use that oil as leverage against potential competitors. They can have greater control of the world oil market. This is their oil vision. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, they want to open up Iraq to the forces of globalization, globalization at gunpoint. This is what their agenda is. This is why it is key to their global plans. This is why does George Bush call Iraq the central front of the war on terror? It's not because Iraq was connected with Al-Qaeda. It's not even because the majority of people resisting the United States in Iraq today are members of Al-Qaeda. The reason is, if you understand the war on terror for what it really is, which is a war of terror for greater empire, then Bush is right. Iraq is the central front because it's the central front of this effort to reorder the whole situation, reshuffle the whole deck. This is why, even in the face of massive resistance and unhappiness in Iraq, 80% of the people, according to a recent poll, view the U.S. as occupiers, not liberators. Even in the face of, and I'm sure he dismisses them as a focus group, just like he dismissed us before the protests, before the war of 2003. Even in the face of this, Bush is willing, even as they're tactically maneuvering, even as they're tactically trying to shift gears and back off a little in the cities and get some of the Sunnis from the Ba'ath regime in power. Remember de-Ba'athification? I guess that's ancient history now. Even as they're doing these, they're committed to, quote, staying the course, unquote. This is why Bush's speeches sound like a broken record. They sound as if he could have given the same speech a year ago. This is why the United States government does not have good options. This is why they're willing to use massive violence, and they're saying that they're going to keep at least 138,000 troops in Iraq till the end of 2005, and who knows how much longer. And this is why I think we should understand very clearly that whoever gets into office, there could be a great escalation of this war after the elections. They hope that installing this rump government is going to make things better for them, but in all likelihood, it's only going to increase the anger and resistance of the Iraqi people, as they see very clearly that this is simply a surrogate for the United States in Iraq. But make no mistake here, the U.S. has these grand plans, grand ambitions, willing to use violence to try to accomplish them. They have a big, big, big problem in Iraq. I don't know if any of you heard Al Gore's statement the other day, his speech. He said this was the worst blunder in U.S. history, something with catastrophic consequences for U.S. power. And as Anthony said in the earlier panel, this is a much more difficult situation for them in many ways than Vietnam. And the problem is this. It's like that old Clash song. Remember this? Should I stay or should I go? If I stay, there will be trouble. If I go, there will be double. This is the situation the U.S. is involved in. If they stay, the resistance is likely to get stronger and more intense over time, perhaps sooner than we think. Who could have predicted what's happening now? If they leave, it's an enormous blow to their entire global agenda and the global power of the United States, which could have far-reaching reverberation. And the other problem that they're facing is that their difficulties are embedded in the very character of the occupation, in the real limits of U.S. power today, in the kinds of transformations the United States ruling class is trying to carry out around the world and carry out in Iraq. This isn't simply a matter of a few blunders or a few stupid mistakes that somebody made that can be easily corrected. And this is why they're sinking down into the abyss, potentially, with this occupation. What am I talking about, that these problems are embedded? First of all, why did Don Rumsfeld use a small, relatively small force in Iraq and dismiss Shinseki when he said they needed 300,000 people? He did because Iraq was only phase two of a global war, and they didn't want to get bogged down. They wanted to restructure the armed forces so it's able to intervene and conquer one country after the other, fight two or three wars at the same time, and not be overstretched. Obviously, that didn't work. They're good at adding up the number of aircraft carriers and nuclear weapons they have, but they're not very good about understanding the heart and soul and the minds of the people of the world and taking that into account in what they do. Why else was this embedded? One of the panelists last night mentioned this. The disaster in post-war Iraq is embedded in 13 years of sanctions, which destroyed Iraq's economy. One of the things that angered me no end was when these embedded journalists walked into Iraq after the war. Do people remember this? And all of a sudden they'd say, "Why, this place is a mess. Look at what Saddam Hussein has done to this country." And these were the same people reporting on sanctions for the last 10 years, and they didn't even bother to talk about what kind of an impact the sanctions has. That tells you how skewed an agenda and politically controlled the coverage is in this country. So that's another facet of the embedded character of this disaster. The other thing is the dramatic sweep of the political changes they want to impose. Again, as I've mentioned, flying these exiles in that have no connection to the Iraqi people. Look, why couldn't the U.S. overthrow Saddam Hussein like they wanted in the 90s? Because the exile forces they relied on had no standing in Iraq. Nobody follows these people. The Kurds are a bit of a different situation. But Ahmad Chalabi, the Iraqi National Accord, this clown they've appointed prime minister now, these people don't have any political support. So you go in, you impose them, you try to do the day zero thing that somebody was talking about last night, wipe the slate clean. All this does is convince Iraqis that you're there to conquer their country and take it over. So many who initially were sort of neutral are now in resistance, are now opposing this. The same thing goes for the sweep of the economic plans. One of the first things the U.S. did was dismiss everyone who worked for the Iraqi military and destroyed the Iraqi state. Dilip mentioned this last night. That's a third of the population. So all of a sudden you have 500,000 people out of work. Knocking down trade barriers has led to a deluge of foreign products that have crushed Iraqi businesses and small entrepreneurs. The resistance is embedded in the occupation. And this is happening at a time when the U.S. empire does not have the financial wherewithal to buy its way out of this. There is no Marshall Plan for Iraq. It is also happening at a time not of growing acceptance of the U.S. presence in the Middle East, but over a decade of growing anger against the United States in the Middle East because of what they've done to Iraq, to Palestine, and supporting these various dictators in the region. So what we're seeing in Iraq today is not simply something that built in the last 6 months. This has been building for years and years. Do you think these Iraqis who've lost a son or a daughter to sanctions have all of a sudden forgotten about that? Of course they haven't. So this is, and I just, one of the messages of Abu Ghraib is the fact that the U.S. is facing a broad-based resistance and they have no idea who it is. You know, they took in 43,000 Iraqis through their prison system. This shows that they were just sweeping people up because they had no idea who the resistance is, but they knew that it was being supported by the population. This is a Vietnam-type situation in that way. So what should we do about all this? We have to oppose the occupation. We have to demand the U.S. get out yesterday. Nothing good can come of what the United States is doing. Let's never mistake what we think should be done and what we would like to see done with what the U.S. government, the U.S. establishment, the Bush team, or whoever's in power is going to do. They have an agenda that I've been describing that it is not about liberation. As long as they're there, they're going to pursue that agenda. And I say this as someone who understands that there is not an angel waiting in the wings in Iraq, not some sort of a revolutionary, just-based mass movement that can simply come in and take power and make life better in Iraq immediately. Maybe such organizations or movements will be formed, but nonetheless, Iraq should be for Iraqis. The Iraqi people have the right to write their own history, to exercise self-determination. And as we've seen lately, remember all the talk of civil war? Oh, it's going to be a civil war. It's going to be chaos. Well, I can't tell you precisely what's going to happen, but if the trend lines continue, the civil war is going to be against the U.S. occupation, and we're going to see the greater unity of Sunnis and Shia in Iraq in the future. I want to come back to what I think we should do more broadly. I want to talk about how to resist this. But right now I want to broaden the discussion a bit to the domestic agenda of the Bush team. This goes beyond what I talk about in my book, but this is the fun part. Because again, I feel that we have to I feel there are connections to be made here, and I think that we have to understand these connections to effectively resist what's going on. In brief, I think things like growing domestic repression here, an effort to take away our civil liberties, an effort to impose a fundamentalist strand of Christianity on the population, an effort to create a police state, an effort to enforce white and male supremacy are all very closely connected with the Bush war around the world. The empire is vulnerable abroad, as I mentioned earlier in the panel. It is also vulnerable at home. And that vulnerability is what's driving these steps that the United States is taking around the world and in the United States. Let's talk about U.S. society for just a minute. As you know, this society is growing more diverse by the day. It's more diverse diverse ethnically, it's more diverse racially, it's more diverse by country of origin, by ideology, by religion, by politics. I like it. I think these are great changes that have happened. It's not Pleasantville anymore. We don't have to watch Leave It to Beaver and pretend like that's even a dim reflection of reality in this country. But the problem for the rulers is they see these changes as tremendously threatening. They see these changes as undermining the social fabric. Samuel Huntington, I don't know if people have noticed, he has a new book about this on. And would it be good to open one of the back doors and get a little more air in the place? Can we do that? Is that legal? Okay, great. Yeah, open the door. So people like Huntington and George Bush and John Ashcroft feel these changes are quite threatening because, after all, what has been the glue that has held this country together? Male supremacy, white supremacy, traditional morality, traditional relations, traditional religious beliefs. So these changes are quite threatening to them. And what makes it worse, in their view, is these changes are not taking place at a time of economic prosperity. They're taking place at a time of enormous economic restructuring around the world, driven by what I've mentioned, the forces of capitalist globalization. The working class in this country, and we're here someplace in the vicinity of the Rust Belt, I think, of the United States. The working class has been restructured over the years. When I went to high school, and, you know, it wasn't that long ago, but when I went to high school, I could have graduated from high school, took that diploma, got a job in a factory, bought a house, and supported a family. Now, I wouldn't have been living high on the hog. It would have been paycheck to paycheck, but it was possible to do that. That possibility is not even remotely the case today, at least in most parts of the country. You're lucky if you get a job at Walmart these days rather than a well-paying factory job. And these assaults have even extended to the middle class in the form of rising costs of health care, for example, and the rising costs of education and housing. There's also a broad-based assault on the social safety net. Welfare is gone. Now Social Security and Medicare are in their sights. And if you think I'm kidding, some of this was illustrated by what the right wing wants to do with a dime. Have people heard about this? You look at the dime now and you've got FDR looking to the left. They want to put Ronald Reagan looking to the right. This is sort of symbolic of what they want to do. I mean, what were the themes of George Bush's State of the Union? And see their connections. He made the connections for us. The themes of the State of the Union were war on terror, this war for greater empire that has no end, that has no specifics, whoever they say it is. You know, one week it's one person, the next week it's somebody else. The Patriot Act, an opposition to gay marriage. Well, what is the Patriot Act? The Patriot Act is an act that allows this proven liar, George Bush, to designate any of us enemy combatants and whisk us to the undisclosed location. And I'm not talking about where Dick Cheney and Antonin Scalia and his buddies hang out and discuss war planning. I'm talking about the place you don't get a phone call, you don't get a lawyer, your family doesn't even know what's happening to you. This is preemptive counterinsurgency, because if you fight a war that's unending, they know there's going to be opposition to this war. If you're assaulting the population economically, politically, culturally, and ideologically, they know there's going to be opposition to this, and they're trying to put themselves in a position they can clamp down on. I mean, look at these terror alerts. I mean, this is the, I'm sorry, I'm not reading whatever intelligence they claim they're getting, but my gut feeling is this is a bunch of malarkey. This is politically driven manipulation of the population, not only to terrify people. And remember, we're being made to be more afraid today than we were when the Soviet Union had 8,000 nuclear warheads pointed against this country. And of course, if these people wanted to actually save American lives, they'd force people to stop smoking and driving SUVs, which kill far more people every year. I think smoking is 400,000 people, and auto accidents kill 55, 60,000 people a year. If they actually wanted to point to the things that you actually may die of, those are certainly more likely than some sort of a terror attack. So they're using this not only to frighten the population, but to put in place the mechanisms to round people up and to put troops in the streets and to declare martial law. I mean, they did a blitzkrieg in Iraq. They could do one here. I mean, this reminds me of 7 days in May. And here we've got the Republican convention coming up, which I'm going to talk about. Who's to say they're not going to try to use terror alerts to suppress dissent and suppress protest? What about this gay marriage thing? I mean, I had to laugh. I'm from San Francisco, and I took pride in the fact that our city opened the floodgates for gay marriage. I felt that this outpouring was right. Amen. You know. I felt this was not only an outpouring of love and commitment, but actually an act of defiance in the current climate. Friends of mine went down to City Hall, got hitched, and so on. I mean, but look at the reaction of Bush and these people. I mean, oh my God, civilization is ending. We need to have a constitutional amendment. And then Schwarzenegger, you may know the governor of California is the Terminator, but which is probably what he should be called. His reaction, and it's interesting because people don't know this, but during his campaign, he actually said that he believed gay marriage should be between a man and a woman. That was what he thought it should be. But after San Francisco opened the floodgates, he was talking about people dead in the streets and all the rest of it. And of course, it's if you think about it one way, it's absurd. I mean, here are people lining up to tie the knot at City Hall, no less, and it's looked at as an act of revolution and subversion. And on one hand, that's ludicrous. On the other, if you understand what these people are trying to do in terms of imposing traditional morality, outlawing alternative lifestyles, imposing traditional religious values, it makes perfect sense what they're doing. And make no mistake, the issue of gay marriage is a wedge issue for a broader agenda of patriarchy and suppressing women's rights. This is why it was no accident that while the furor over gay marriage has gone on, there's been also John Ashcroft has been sending his minions to hospitals to investigate women who've had abortion. There's this bill in the Congress passed that giving fetuses certain legal rights, which is just a step to outlaw abortion. And make no mistake, this is not a question of the right to life. These people who push this have never met a war and execution they did not support. Have you ever seen any of these people holding up a picture of Iraqi children who've suffered or died because of sanctions and demanded an end to sanctions under the rubric of the right to life? Of course not. Of course not. This isn't about the right to life. This is about suppressing women's rights. Because if women don't have the right to control reproduction, they don't have any rights whatsoever. And I was delighted to see a million people turn out in Washington, D.C., finally, to oppose this sort of thing. I want to talk about this effort to impose religion throughout society and to whittle away the barrier between church and state. People think I'm exaggerating sometimes when I talk about this. I'm going to give a few examples here. Do people hear about this American Airlines flight from L.A. to New York in January? Anybody hear about that? Few people. That's good. A few. It's always like this. Very few people have heard. Everybody should have heard about this. The pilot gets on the microphone and he doesn't say, "Oh, have a nice day. Thank you for flying, Mary." He says, "How many of you on board are Christians? Raise your hand." When people raised their hand, he said, "The rest of you are nuts. You should spend the rest of this flight talking to your Christian passenger mates, seatmates." Of course, people got on their cell phone, called home, "I love you." They thought he was going to fly the plane into a building. And you know what's most outrageous about this is there's been no outrage. And you're a well-informed audience. Most people have never heard about this. It was in the news for one day and then it's gone. Why? Because this is the kind of right-wing fundamentalist fascist mentality that they want to encourage. They don't want to suppress this. Here's another example. How many of you have been to the Grand Canyon? Raise your hands. Okay, some of you may have heard this one too. Grand Canyon was formed 5 to 6 million years ago by the action of the Colorado River through the limestone and sandstone formations in southern Utah, northern Arizona. This took place over hundreds of thousands, millions of years, according to the geologists. And we get the beautiful natural wonder we have down there today. Well, recently the Bush administration forced the national parks to carry a book called Another View. This view argued that the Grand Canyon had been created in 6 days 3,000 years ago. And then we've got Mel Gibson's movie. I call it Mad Max the Preacher's Son. I know there are different ways to understand this movie. I get emails about this. But the core of the movie, I believe it's effective. Certainly the way the fundamentalists understand this movie is not simply that it is anti-Semitic, which it is, but it's a recruiting tool for the Christian right to galvanize its social base and organize its social base to be an army of God against the rest of us and the world. And if you don't believe me, some friends of mine in the Revolutionary Communist Youth Brigade, I was in New York speaking then, and it was when the movie was opening, they went to the movie lines and handed out a leaflet condemning this movie, and they ran into these evangelicals who were recruiting, and the evangelicals gave them this. It's a Bible, it says Bible up here, but it also says Operation Enduring Freedom. And it's got an eagle. This is a war in Afghanistan. This is onward Christian soldiers. Because what better way to try to get the population to go along with an unjust war than blind religious obedience? And if you don't, and again, if you don't believe me, let's listen to the words of George W. Bush speaking to Bob Woodward. Going into the period before deciding on his war against Iraq, I was praying for strength to do the Lord's will. I'm surely not going to justify war based on God. Understand that. Of course, then he says the opposite. Nevertheless, in my case, I pray that I be as good a messenger of his will as possible. So we've got this toxic combination of imperialism and religious fundamentalism, to whatever degree these people actually believe all this, being used to justify the most brutal crimes, the most aggressive war against the world. And I think this is something that we have an enormous responsibility to fight to stop. And I also think we have an enormous opportunity to fight to stop this. Because as we saw in the run-up to the war in 2003, as we are seeing today in Iraq, as will no doubt grow greater in the future, this empire is vicious, but it's incredibly vulnerable, and it has stirred up a storm of resistance to its actions. If I had been standing here a year ago and telling you what would transpire in Iraq over the next 12 months, you would not have believed it, and I probably wouldn't have believed it either. It's astounding how fast this has gone wrong. So on one hand, we have to understand the severity, the gravity, the enormity of the moment. On the other, we cannot be paralyzed by hopelessness and fear and the feeling we can't do anything about this, because I believe there's an enormous amount we can do about it, and I'm going to touch on some of the things I do think we should do. How are we doing time-wise? What's it? Oh, good. God, I might finish early. That'll be a record. I had to beg for more time on Book TV, not from Book TV, but at the Commonwealth Club. I had to ask the support of the audience, which they gave me. I want to talk about three things. Oh, God, I just about forgot. I can't go without doing this. Part of my answer to this whole Christian right-wing sort of a thing is to join a new baseball team that's just been formed. I don't know if people have seen this new team yet. I'm not sure if it's going to be in the National League or the American League, but, I'm going to sign up.
What does it say?
Atheist.
Oh,
This is, if people aren't familiar, this looks just like an Oakland Athletics, the baseball team, T-shirt. And a lot of people, if you wear this, they just think you're wearing an Oakland A's shirt, you know. So it's kind of a Bay Area thing, right, Paul? Okay. Kind of, but, you know, it has some appeal. So in terms of what we should do, I want to talk about three things. I want to talk about truth. I want to talk about vision. I want to talk about resistance. Your heart is nourished through your head. If you don't understand why things are happening, who's responsible, what's going on, you're not going to be able to resist. You're going to be paralyzed. You're going to be disoriented. Your heart is nourished through your head. And one of the wonderful things that's happening now is the outpouring of alternative information that's taking place. Anthony's book, someone mentioned that he had edited. Of course, Dillip has written dozens of books. We've got tons of literature out there. There's an outpouring of internet sites, of alternative radio, and so on. And I really think this is the kind of thing we need to strengthen. And I want to just very quickly mention three sources that I believe in, that I think are excellent and essential, and I want to recommend to people. And the first is going to shock you. This is my book, Oil, Power, and Empire. I'm a shameless self-promoter, let's face it. But seriously, I do think it's a very powerful tool for changing people's minds about the war. I would really encourage people to use it as a resource and help me get word of this book out. Common Courage is a great publisher, but like a lot of small alternative publishers, they have no resources. So I count on the grassroots to get the word out, and I certainly hope people here can do that. So there's my book. The other thing I want to mention is the Bob Avakian essay that I cited on the panel that gives a picture of this global agenda. I have a bunch of these out there. It's either in print form, New Situation, Great Challenges, or on a CD. I think it's the most succinct and accurate analysis of the current moment that's out there. I also wanted to mention there are a bunch of tapes of my speeches out there. And finally, I wanted to point to the Revolutionary Worker. It's one of the papers I write for. It's online at rwor.org, and week after week it exposes the truth and covers stories that aren't covered and gives direction to the struggle. And I have to tell you, I was on an NPR a station, I won't mention the city, very nice guy, but at one point he said, geez, do you really believe that Bush was lying? I mean, and then he said, and you know, are people going to listen to you because you've written in the Revolutionary Worker? And I was too polite to say this back, but I felt like saying, look, if you'd been reading the Revolutionary Worker or other papers as well, other left, you know, alternative papers, if you'd been reading it, you wouldn't ask me if Bush was lying. You would know the answer to that, you know. So who has credibility, the alternative press or the mainstream press? So anyway, the Revolutionary Worker. I want to talk about vision. You know, I feel the truth, search for truth has to be linked to a discussion of vision, a discussion of the alternatives to the current society, discussion of the question, is another world possible? And I realize this goes beyond, you know, what the grassroots network or any of the other anti-war groups are really going to take up organizationally, but I still think it's important for all of us to take this up. I think that one of the most damning lies we're told is not weapons of mass destruction, is not Al-Qaeda, is not Saddam Hussein was in bed with Osama bin Laden. It's the notion that there's nothing better than global capitalism, that this is the highest society that humanity could ever create, that history's ended, that any attempt to change the world has been an abysmal failure. Don't even go there. That's the tenor of the media coverage and discussion in this country, and it's got to change. It's got to stop. I mean, this is intolerable. This current system is a disaster for this planet. Every single day, there are over 2 billion people trying to exist on $2 a day or less. Every day, more and more gas and fumes are being poured into the atmosphere. And if global warming continues at its current pace by 2050, not only will Glacier National Park have no glaciers, the Times even ran an article the other day in their travel section, if you want to see glaciers, you better hurry up. Not only that, but 37% of the plant and animal species on this beautiful earth could become extinct by 2050. This is a crime and a disaster. And you know what makes it even worse? We're not living in 1400 when we did not know how to save the planet, when we did not know how to feed the hungry, when we did not know how to cure the sick. The technology, the wisdom, the knowledge is there, but it is imprisoned in the relations of capital. If it doesn't make a buck, if it doesn't confer some kind of competitive advantage on somebody, it's not done. This is an outrage. And I believe in a world where that knowledge, that wisdom, that technology, those resources are used to serve humanity, no matter what color, no matter what nation, no matter where they are on the planet Earth. This should not be used to benefit a handful of nations or a handful of individuals. And I want to say more. I want to say that I believe the efforts to create this kind of a world, the communist revolutions of the 20th century, were not the unmitigated disasters they are presented. I think they were the first steps to try to change thousands and thousands of years of class society. I think these attempts were defeated. I'm certainly under no illusion that they were perfect or ushered in some sort of an instant utopia. They did, most certainly did not. But I think the challenge now is not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but to understand the achievements of those efforts, to uphold them, to criticize them where they need to be criticized, to take it further, to make it better. But again, this is a conversation we need to have. Is there an alternative to this system? And finally, I want to end with a call to resistance. As we're searching for truth, as we're debating and arguing over what sort of a vision that we want to have for the world, we need to come together and resist in unprecedented ways. When I say this, a lot of times people say, well, we tried before 2003, it didn't do any good. I think it did an enormous amount of good. On February 15th, 2003, when 15 million people were in the streets, I'm sure many of you felt like I did. There was an instant sense of global community. You felt a bond with people in Berlin and Tokyo and Cairo and Amman, much more in common with them than the rulers of this country. It showed millions of people around the world that everyone in this country is not a clone of George W. Bush. That we are not allowing this to go on in our name. This movement also changed the political dynamic and discussion in this country. Again, not to be localist about this, but out in the Bay Area, you could hardly find anti-war coverage 6 months before the war, but a month or two before, the Chronicle, they'd have front page articles. Oh, here's how you get to the next protest. You get on BART, you go here, you go there. You know, this is a front page news. So it changed the news coverage, and it gave the U.S. a tremendous political defeat, which was number one, to not allow the UN to give some sort of a rubber stamp to this war, and prevented the opening of a northern front in Turkey. These were very significant, defeats for the United States. So our task is not to disparage mass resistance. Our task is to make it broader, make it deeper, and make it more determined. and the vision that I know that all the different groups are doing good work and involved in a number of different things, but I think it's very important for us to make a statement this August at the Republican National Convention, where the effort's going to be there to coronate George Bush the second and to create some sort of a mandate for this ongoing war on the world in the name of protecting America, as if American life was somehow more precious than anybody else's life. I think this is a moment where we could turn the tide by doing as Not in Our Name and other anti-war groups are calling for, by bringing over 1 million people into the streets of New York, of making a statement that cannot be ignored by the press, that no matter who gets elected, millions of us are determined to end this unjust war in Iraq and to prevent further wars and to oppose attacks on our civil liberties. I think there are moments like this when the resistance and the anti-war movement and the peace movement have to come together and muster our forces and put the kind of exclamation point on resistance that's going to send shockwaves through this country and awaken many thousands of people who don't think that there's an anti-war movement anymore and who don't know what's going on and who are looking for direction. And I think that this could be our Chicago 1968 that turns the tide against the Vietnam War. I'm not saying the situation is identical. They had nowhere near 1 million in Chicago, and we've got to have over 1 million in New York. But I think this is an effort that we have to put all our hearts and souls into, because it's not going to happen without that. And this is the kind of focus and focused energy and struggle we need to change the political equation in this country. And so I certainly hope all of the groups that are and people that are here can join in this effort to make this happen, because it's not, you know, if it was hard, a lot of work to organize this conference, think how much work it is to organize over 1 million people to come to New York. And from what I've heard, there are many groups involved in this. It's very exciting already, and we need to make this kind of a statement and have the courage to come out in the face of no doubt, which is going to be a heavy police presence, and make our voices heard. And here I want to say something that I know is going to be even more controversial than the communism thing. You ready? This is how they introduced me at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. He's a man of controversy. And I got an email from some other part of the country that said, "Gee, Larry, I can see you're out there in Berkeley, and of course, who else is going to have you but the Commonwealth Club?" And obviously, this person writing this email thought the Commonwealth Club was some sort of a communist front group. You know, the Commonwealth Club is like the World Affairs Council in San Francisco. You know, it's a very mainstream place. But it was interesting, because the audience was very receptive to what I said, because many people of all walks of life are upset about this Iraq business and the direction things are going in. So there's many diverse voices and sections of the population that we have to rally to oppose this, and some people are going to march, and some people are going to do vigils, and some people are going to write letters, and some people are going to stage plays and concerts, and we've got to have it all going on focused on New York. But anyway, the more controversial point is this. I don't think we can focus all our energies on these elections. Just voting for, and again, I say this, whether you vote, you don't vote, whoever you vote for, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about energy spent. And the reason being is that the Democrats have made clear that they have written anti-war off the agenda. You know, a lot of times when I talk, people are Kucinich supporters, and they say, well, Kucinich is different. And he is different, and that's why he has no money and no chance to win. I mean, selecting, and look at what they did to Howard Dean. Who pulled the plug on Howard Dean? You know, the media and the establishment did. He supposedly screamed. Do people know this? He supposedly screamed. It was repeated 700 times in the press. Suddenly, Howard Dean was not electable, right? And what was the reality? If you had been at the rally where this happened, you couldn't have even heard Howard Dean scream. The only reason it sounded loud was they had a directional mic that muffled the sound around him. He was in some hall. Everybody was screaming. But all you could hear was this. The media played it 700 times. Why? Because they wanted to make sure the anti-war position was not on the agenda at a time, as the editors of the Weekly Standard put it, when the war in Iraq and the war in terror hung in the balance. I'm not a Howard Dean supporter, but that's why they pulled the plug on him. And who did they select? They selected someone who is pro-war, who is pro-Patriot Act, who wants to have more allies in Iraq, who wants to add 40,000 more troops, who wants to do this right. Well, first of all, allies. I mean, is it somehow make the conquest of a country better if you have allies to do it? It's like saying that it's wrong to rob a gas station if you do it by yourself, but if you posse up with your buddies, then it's okay. It's not okay. And doing it right, what does doing it right mean? John Kerry hasn't renounced the U.S. right to be the world's number one superpower. He endorsed that. He claims he'll do a better job of that than George Bush. He just gave a speech the other day and said that. He hasn't renounced the right to control Middle East oil. How did our oil get under their sand, as I've heard Kucinich say once or twice? He hasn't renounced any of this. And I think that these elections are being used to try to derail the struggle, to try to channel our energy away from grassroots, bottom-up activism. And after all, that's what stopped the Vietnam War. Right. Not the elections didn't. Elections are the way, not the way the people control the system. Elections are one of the ways that the system attempts to control the people, and we are seeing that today. Look at what choice we have. What's our choice? Our choice is between a white, Yale-educated, multimillionaire, member of the Skull and Bone Society, who voted for the war. And the other choice is a white, Yale-educated, multimillionaire, Skull and Bones guy who carried out the war. Is this our choice? Who made that choice for us? So I'm. Well, I no. I think we have to resist from the bottom up. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about what we did in the 60s. I'm talking about what we did leading up to the 2003 war. This is a much harder row to hoe than simply going into a ballot booth and pulling a lever. It's much more challenging, but this is the challenge that we are confronted with, and I think that this is the challenge that we have to rise to and find the ways, the diverse and multifaceted ways to do this. And I want to end by a quote that I think captures some of what we want to do. It's a quote from John le Carré, his new book, Absolute Friends. I'm not endorsing the book, but I like this quote. He says, in terms of us getting out of our comfort zone, in terms of us really confronting what we're up against, in terms of us trying to do things we have never done before and struggling with other people to do things they have never done before, he says, it's about becoming real after too many years of pretending. This is his character who's awakened to anger against the Iraq war. It's about becoming real after too many years of pretending. It's about putting the brakes on human self-deception, starting with my own. And I think that's something that we all have to challenge ourselves to do. And finally, I want to end where I began with The Lord of the Rings. Again, I'm not giving a movie review here, but I love the image of the smallest, most humble, most forgotten, weakest creatures on the planet suddenly being thrust with the destiny of humanity, having that burden placed on their shoulders. And them having Frodo and his band, having to struggle with you know, whether they were up to the challenge. Could they go to hell and back and accomplish this mission? Could they muster the courage? Could they muster the strength? All the while wondering, why me? Why me? Why can't someone else do this for us? Well, there is nobody else to do it for us. We have to do this for ourselves, and we've got to be the Frodos of this planet and stop this juggernaut of war and repression. Thank you so much.